Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to this very special Three Flavours Cornetto Trilogy podcast, celebrating the brilliance of Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright's, well, Three Flavours Cornetto Trilogy, which is, of course, the rom-som-com Shaun of the Dead, the rom-cop-com Hot Fuzz, and the rom-rum-com The World's End. And yes, I know they don't drink rum in The World's End, but just go with it. Please, just go with it. The trilogy is out now on DVD and Blu-ray, and to mark this auspicious occasion, Nick DeSimeon and I spoke to Pegg and Wright just the other day for a mammoth, marathon, 75-minute-long interview spanning all three films and a history of their working relationship. The interview took place at the Cineworld Haymarket in London while we were waiting to go on stage for one of their final World's End Q&As, and I captured them in frank, funny and reflective mood. Needless to say, this is filled with spoilers for the trilogy, so don't listen to it until you've seen all three films. Enjoy. We're delighted to welcome on the Empire Podcast for an exhaustive Three Flavours Cornetto Empire Podcast, Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg. Welcome.
Hello.
Exhausted or exhausted?
Both.
Good.
Let's go for both.
That's one of our little...
That's one of your favourite words, isn't it?
Jokes. We like saying things that are only in trade reviews, like exhaustive doc. Talking in variety speak.
We like to have an exhaustive commentary on our DVDs.
So let's make this commentary really exhaustive.
Because right now, we're in the Cineworld Haymarket. We're about four stories above the screening where it's happening right now. Yeah. The World's End's playing for, I don't know, this is probably the last Q&A or second last Q&A you guys could be doing for
first
this
one. First time in the West End, isn't it?
Yeah.
I know this is actually the first Q&A that we have done in this country for this movie.
I know.
It's one of the reasons we're doing three Q&As this week is because we felt guilty that time was against us and we had to go around the world and we never actually did a Q&A in the
UK. You did.
What's that?
You did.
What do you mean?
Well, I'm a mercenary bastard. I don't care.
Sam didn't care.
Edgar feels. Edgar's got all the feels.
But do you feel is there a sense of closure now coming in? With you got two Q&As left, three in your case, Edgar, of course.
I felt closure. It's weird. I felt closure at various stages of this process. I felt closure on the last day of principal photography. I felt closure on the last day of pickups. Of the LA premiere, of the London premiere. You know, it's weird.
What about the second day of pickups?
Second day of pickups. The third and fourth day of pickups, not so much. But yeah, it's weird. It's little increments of closure. I guess really when the DVD, Blu-ray is out and we've done everything, in the build-up to that, then it will be like, okay, that's it. There we go.
You just go and stare into space for a while?
Man, and love it. Enjoy it. Just think about it all. It's been, it's been such a fun ride, and it's only part one of a greater ride, I think. So it's nice to kind of, it's good to feel we've had this.
When we finished our last commentary, I walked out and I walked up the road accompanied by the music from the end of Incredible Hulk
with your bag slung over your back. I feel like we've had this thing hanging over us for years because of Spaced, because it became like a running joke about the third, this mythic third series that we never did. I'm glad that we've completed something at least. It's like people aren't going to go, so when are you going to do a third Cornetto film? Because we plumbing did it.
You've just ruined my next question, which was, will there be a series of Spaced?
There'll be a fourth series of Spaced, which is Nick's joke.
Yeah, just skip to that. We want to go back to the beginning. I mean, in terms of this being an exhaustive podcast, right to the back to the very beginning, because you guys were in the same room at one point without knowing about it.
I think we were.
Is that Bristol
Watershed. Yeah. Big ups to the West Country. Bristol Watershed had an animation festival, I think, in 1988.
That's right, yeah.
And there was a UK premiere of Akira, and me and my brother were there, but unbeknownst to us.
Elsewhere in the darkness.
Simon Pegg was there, lurking like the editor of Doctor Who. So we only found that out later, I think, when we were doing Asylum or...
I think when we were doing Spaced, because I wrote it into the script.
That's right.
Yeah. And
we both said, like,
that's weird.
I was at the UK premiere of that.
What must you have? I was looking through David Williams' biography yesterday. There's some pictures of you, and there's a picture of you and him and Matt Lucas on the set of Bernard Chumley's Stately Homes.
Yeah.
And I swear to God, you look like a child. I did I know you then? And I did. We've known each other for such a long time. It's crazy.
I know.
Because now you look like a man.
I know.
Almost.
And the first time you met properly was you were doing some stand up, and you did a bit.
No,
of
I was. Country. Funnily enough, I was seeing Matt and Dave at the Riverside. Edgar maintained. I always
you
think.
You finally conceded.
I always think it's the Battersea Arts Centre, but I think you're right. I think we met there again later.
Yeah, we did with Nick. That's right.
Because
the
I remember
first time I met Nick was at the Battersea Arts.
That's right. Because I remember when I did see you, I knew I'd seen you before. Because I remember thinking, who is that? Because my memory of you is like you had a velvet jacket on.
Am I off?
You look like the Doctor.
I came up to, it was at the Riverside Studios. I came up to Simon because I had seen, and you can find this on YouTube, this clip, Simon on the stand-up show from 1996, maybe. Or maybe 95?
I look like Eminem.
You do. And I went up, and because Simon had done a whole... routine about, was it Points West or HTV?
HTV, it was about the West Country sort of local news channel and, you know, obvious stand-up about sort of parochial sort of tendencies.
About students
of,
and traffic of local which news. Then is in Hot Fuzz.
Yeah, absolutely. And Edgar came over to sort of like, you know, said he, because he obviously came from the HTV area and we bonded over that. And I remember, I knew he was connected with us now somehow. It was because Matt and David sort of... I mean, groomed you, really, didn't they?
And I they had assumed I was gay, and then I was part of their circle.
And this is before the internet.
Wait, who's this kid? He might be
gay. It wasn't so easy in those days. You had to do it by mail. Very slow process. And the irony was they were grown up by the time they finally came round. But no, I started to see Edgar around the Paramount Comedy Channel, and we were all... It was a little hotbed of kind of creation... My family Moore, who was a university friend of mine, became a producer at the Paramount Comedy Channel and was charged to produce some domestic comedy for their for sort of buffers on the Paramount Channel, which was showing like Cheers and Seinfeld and stuff like that. Mm. And Matt and David got Edgar to direct their show Mash and Peas, and I was doing a little show.
The other connected tissue there that was funny is the reason I met Matt Lucas is I had seen him on another stand-up show, and he was doing stand-up at the Fox on Palmer's Green, and I went up to him afterwards because I had written the script of Crawl, and I sort of thought that, like, here's this kid who's the same age as me. He would be funny in the script that I've written. So I sort of met him through that, and we became friends, and I met David. And then later, like, Fistful of Fingers came out and got one star in Empire.
Bumped up to three.
Never gonna let us forget that.
Thank you, Caroline Westerbrook. I haven't memorized the review.
How long was the review, by the way?
It was only a short one. I remember. I did.
It was
remember
one star.
It
was it?
It was one
star. Need I say more?
No, the one nice thing, the only nice thing that it said is it said sort of like there's just enough talent in the director to predict that he might be ashamed in the future of foam horses. That was the one like nice thing to say that there is like
and
a
are
gem.
You?
No, I like the. You know what? I've come. I at the time I was. I think when I made that film, which is very very silly, I had a sort of a moment when I'd made it. Afterwards, when I was editing it, I suddenly realized that I'd committed something to film, and there was no way back. And I sort of realized that there was. I realized the big difference between an amateur film and a professional film, and mine was very much still in the amateur camp.
Because when you were with me, it went up to four, didn't it?
Simon literally added three stars.
Which ironically, every film I do without you gets three stars.
That's it. We only like together. How does that explain Scott Pilgrim versus the World? Five stars.
I know.
Let's not make this about us, guys. Although we haven't seen Caroline for a while.
So Matt Lucas and David Walliams went to see Fistful of Fingers, and they hired me to do their show Mash and Peas on the Paramount Comedy Channel. And then when I was shooting that, I remember Simon was shooting Dan Doyle, and so we ran into each other a bunch of times.
And that's because Mifanwi, who was a Bristol alumnus, she had got me and Dave Walliams in because we were friends of hers, and she was basically, you know, getting the people that she knew to sort of bolster this little group of comedians. So, and that's how, and then when we did Asylum together, we had a bunch of comics. We did a first workshop, and a bunch of comics got a bit funny about the subject material because it was set in a mental facility, and people thought it was a bit sick. And we were like, nah, it's funny. And so a whole bunch of comics pulled out, and we were left with a dearth of, well, were there any female characters? And I'd done a sketch show for Meridian TV with a young actress by the name of Jessica Stevenson, who...
Nee Stevenson.
And I said, listen, I know this amazing... Because she'd blown my mind on this show. She'd come out. She'd come along with Katie Carmichael, who's plays Twist and Spaced. She'd just come with Katie to keep her company on the audition. I'd done the audition just for the hell of it. Blown everybody away at the audition. They gave her a role in the thing. She's all, I can't do it unless Katie does it. So Katie got the part as well. I subsequently got a part in it as well. And worked with Jess and just fell in love with her completely because she is so funny. And I said to Edgar, how about this girl? And so she did Asylum. And then at the end of Asylum, they said, you guys should do something together. And that was Spaced.
Edgar, were you involved in the creation of Spaced at that point? Or were you not aware of it?
No, I was in the sense that I read the first draft. I think early on, Simon and Jess went away to write maybe like four episodes. Or maybe I remember reading them after you'd done two episodes. And so I think very early on, my family or maybe you guys had said, Edgar should do this. And so you, I remember reading the first drafts. But there's a gap between Asylum and Spectre. There was about a two-year gap at least.
2 years, yeah.
Where you did the Steve Coogan tour and Big Train.
Yes.
And I did a bunch of BBC shows.
Yeah. You did Alexi Sale and French and Saunders. And
the French and Saunders One Christmas Special.
Was that the Titanic one?
The Titanic one?
Edgar directed the Titanic one, which is a classic.
It seems bizarre when that's on like sort of UK Gold, thinking, oh yeah, I shot that.
Jess and I went off and wrote this script, which was a kind of flat share sitcom that was supposed to be single camera. That was our only directorial kind of contribution to the script, that it was a single camera, no laugh track kind of deal. And we gave the scripts to Edgar, and Edgar came with this book of like, and his sort of visual style was kind of on the page. And I remember being around at Jessica's house and looking at this book thinking, fuck me, this is amazing, you know? And okay, yeah, you're the one. And, because I've always maintained throughout, you know, always that it was the three, the words were written by Jess and I, but the creation was Edgar, me, and Jess entirely, because there's a whole vein of that show which is to do with how it looks, and that was, you know, entirely Edgar.
So in a sense, you guys write together before you wrote together?
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
You did. He was script editor anyway.
Yeah, I sort of did script editing, especially on the second series.
Well, you were the one that had us rewrite the end of the first episode and turn it into that whole sort of, you know, thing with all the misunderstanding.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. There was nothing at the end of the first episode.
Yeah, it just
sort of
petered out.
It just stopped.
Yeah, yeah. It did. I don't know.
Page 17, that's it. Yeah.
Full stop.
And did you show Simon the stuff you were writing, like Cruel? Or did you keep that?
No.
He showed I still haven't read it.
Yes, you have. You read some of it.
He said, I remember after Space.
Chris wanted me to bring it along today, and so we'd read it aloud, and I said, I said, Simon, will rip it to pieces.
No, it's totally there. It's all, you know, you can see the promise on the page. But he showed me a script he'd written called Tinkle, which is about a guy who tries to answer the phone. And I remember he brought it to me, and I was kind of like, oh, you want me to do this? I remember being quite surprised that you wanted to do something with me beyond Space. And,
yeah.
And I felt quite privileged that you actually had kind of thought of me in that sense.
Was that a TV idea or a...
No, that was a short. I do remember, though, I'm gonna flatter Simon now. Not that he needs it, but like...
cover your ears.
No, but when I was doing Asylum, I was so sort of impressed with Simon that I thought, even before any germ of Shaun of the Dead had come up, thinking, I want to make a movie with this guy. Because, you know, I think you realize it's a great position to be in, to sort of be able to write a script together with somebody and you direct and somebody else star. It's, yeah. You know, those chances come along very infrequently. And I sort of meet a lot of people who want to kind of become directors and sort of like, I don't know how to get their voice across. And sometimes it's like because you don't have somebody who can be in it or you can't write it yourself. And so I feel very lucky that like, I met Simon and we kind of had a shared sensibility, and then we could write a film that I could direct that he could be in. Mm. But I did way before we came up with the idea for Shaun, I thought I want to do a film with Simon, and I'd written this short, which we never ended up doing. But
I think having done three films like that now, it's the ideal way to work, you know, in filming terms, because it gives you utter sort of hold on everything, you know, and we sit down as writers and we work together as writers, and then when we get on set, we fan out like the Falcon and the Lex Wing in Return of the Jedi. You know, he goes off to direct, I become the lead
actor. That was on TV today.
The lead actor.
I happened to switch over just as that Ewok was dying.
Did you? Oh, and the bit when he shakes it.
Yeah.
Oh. But then we take on our respective roles on set.
It felt like watching a strange episode of Badger Watch. Bill Oddie's commentary on a dying Ewok.
Chris Packham just weeping on its body.
He'd probably be happy. He wants pandas to die.
Does he?
He does, yeah. He doesn't think we should keep him alive. He thinks that natural selection has chosen him for extinction.
Wow.
And we shouldn't intervene.
Okay, hell.
Yeah.
Podcast takes a dark twist.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Bloody Packham. Anyway, you were saying...
that deep vein
of hatred for Packham.
Crazy Billy Idol lookalike.
No, he's different now. He's changed his haircut.
Looks like Eric Idol.
Yeah.
So in terms of Shaun... So when you guys got in the room together for the first time, you'd worked together, you knew that you were compatible as writers?
We were very studious about it. We started off around at Edgar's house. watching a lot of films, we respectively read kind of text.
Sid Field, who recently passed away this week. Mm-hmm. R.I.P.
That's right, yeah.
Sid Field.
Robert McKee.
I don't know if we actually read the Robert McKee book.
Isn't it the one that was it Sid Field's book with the one with the diagram and stuff in?
Yeah,
okay,
exactly.
That's the one I remember clearly.
Although, funny enough, Robert McKee is a fan of Shaun of the Dead.
We read that. Sort of,
yeah, but we definitely did. There's the Sid Field book, R.I.P., had that kind of act, kind of paradigm thing. And what we would do is we would watch our favorite movies, or movies that were in the vein of the Shaun of the Dead screenplay, not just kind of content-wise, but structurally. And we would match, we would try and match the events in the movie to his act chart. Okay.
To see if the
to
math
see if it worked.
Okay,
worked.
Yeah.
And most of the time it did. You know, so we would watch things like Back to the Future or American Werewolf in London or Gremlins or The Birds, and try and match it to kind of the chart. So it was kind of a fascinating way of like breaking down your favorite movies into a kit of parts.
Because I think as kind of, as sort of, you know, with Spaced, we'd come at things from left field. We tried to be a bit unconventional. And when someone says, this is how you do something, your immediate reaction is, no, it's not. I'll do it how I like. And we were just curious to see if those rules did apply. And they were, and they did, you know, and really good, well-structured movies that genuinely satisfy you. Raiders, those kind of films that just kind of leave you thinking, oh, that was great. Tend to have a development which is, you know, fairly uniform, and we basically discovered we weren't going to write three consecutive sitcom episodes. We had to write a different kind of animal, yeah. And we've found ourselves in this little upstairs attic stinking room on
Beak Street.
No, it was, but it was the other B. It
Brewer
was
Street.
Brewer. It was on. No, it wasn't Brewer.
Berwick.
It was Berwick. Street.
It was no, Berwick.
Berwick Street.
The three Bs.
Yeah, the three Bs.
70 something. 73 Berwick Street. Don't look for us. Not there anymore.
We knocking shop these days.
No, I think it probably it was then, a to be honest. Shop, and then it was our writing room.
Some Packing guy. Is probably there killing pandas even now.
Rain-coated men used to walk in, and you know, if we weren't inspired that
just
day, we'd give them a hand job and get extra money for press a manger.
20 pounds for French.
I mean, it was the old rates, really.
You know, like 60 for Greek.
There was a sign on the wall from the previous owner. We just used those. We didn't know how to scale it. And then we moved to Big Talk, didn't
Busty
we?
Busty model with model spelled wrong. Model spelled M O D L E. I remember that there was a sign nearby.
French polishing.
model was spelled wrong. Like how like sort of like that's a pretty.
It's because she's French.
Major. It's really genuinely French. Okay, sorry. We deviate. This is all new.
This is all gold. This is all gold.
We haven't done this in an interview before.
We're talking about wanking off.
We haven't admitted
just
that.
Random people walking.
You got to get a film made. You got to do things.
That wasn't a ne'er do well.
I left
Listen,
it out.
First time filmmakers, you're gonna have to do some things that you're ashamed of.
If you're gonna make, you want to make your first film, you're gonna have to nosh up a few tramps. It's a small price to
a McKee style sort of seminar.
That was the first page of McKee, Nosh Off a Tramp.
I know.
Write a script.
Very strange.
Hero's Journey. I was going to ask which one of you types, but.
I think we both do actually, but the other thing that people always ask about writing, and it's like, and listen, the reason that we read all these books is because we'd never written a screenplay before. So we didn't kind of try and like sort of blunder in like naively and just think, yeah, we've done a TV show, now we can write a film. And if anything, we were daunted by it because we wanted it to be really good. So we read all these books. But then the thing is that, and this is where the flip chart thing comes in, the flip chart is essentially like making a big treatment. So I think the way is, if a screenplay is going well, you keep doing the treatment of the plot until you start writing the movie. Because they sort of frequently, especially with something that's a comedy, dialogue starts to drive the plot. And so you have this document, and it's not just plot beats. It starts to become lines from the film as well. So if you look on the Blu-rays of any of the movies where we put the flip chart extra on, you can see as well as major plot beats are bits of dialogue that are driving the film along. So that was what we did. And that's why we first recorded that. On the Shaun of the Dead like DVD and Blu-ray, there's that flip chart extra, which was shot in our knocking shop in Berwick Street.
I think you can see me dabbing the corners of my mouth when it starts.
You can almost smell the talc.
I didn't know you were going to say talc. That was good.
So Sorry, we'll start talking about brothels.
No, that's fine. That's fine. So, in terms of getting Sean off the ground, though, was it because it was quite tricky? It was quite it was touch and go for a long, long time, wasn't it? So, were you writing the script even as you were trying to sell it around?
I look back on it as me being very, I was just very blithely sort of naive about it. I just assumed it would get done. Edgar was obviously more in touch with Naira Park.
And reality.
And Jim Wilson, but basically what happened was it was being developed at Film 4, and we met up with Paul Webster and Jim Wilson, and we loved Paul because he distributed Evil Dead 2 when it came to the UK, so it was like
through Palace.
It was all very sort of like, oh, this feels right. And then Film 4 had to scale down because they had to get smaller quite quickly, and they very kindly put the film into turnaround, and we had it back. And we took Jim with us, Jim Wilson, who stayed with the project. And eventually, on the morning that Joe Strummer died, we were all in Starbucks at the bottom of Upper Street. I remember us discussing the fact that working title...
I think that's you're mixing two things up. Because I remember like, Starbucks was when went to working title. I think we met in Starbucks before we went there, maybe.
But this
I remember we were in Iceland when we got the call.
Oh, yeah.
We were in Iceland, and we got the call that they were going to make it, and that was just before Christmas.
But the Starbucks event was when we had the offer. It was like Working Title have said they'll do.
Oh
this.
Yeah, yeah.
Do we shall we do it? And then we were sat around this table thinking, like Working Title with this awful corporation. You know, little did we know how wonderful our relationship with them would be. But we were like, okay, yeah. And Edgar and I were over in Iceland towards Christmas, just watching a gig and. We weren't in that Blue Lagoon, were we?
We were in the changing room of the Blue Lagoon. And also,
which is a brothel.
Blue Lagoon is what like a volcanic spa. And we had gone, you were there watching a Coldplay, and I was with...
Ash.
Charlotte, because she was in Ash, she was supporting. So we were both there, but I remember it being a very tense time because...
That's very much us. I'm very Coldplay, he's very Ash.
I remember getting that call that it was happening, and it was like just before Christmas, and then in March we were shooting it. But up until that point, that kind of like maybe I think like Film 4 had gone down like a year before that or something. So it was a very tense kind of year of going rapidly broke and just kind of waiting out it maybe happening.
Yeah.
And also for me at least, kind of turning down, I think a little easier for Simon doing acting jobs, but for me to take on a TV job meant that I was like pushing the film back.
Yeah.
So I got lots of TV offers, and I was going rapidly. I was going rapidly broke. Well, not even broke. I was like majorly in the red, and I had borrowed money from Naira, David Walliams, my agent, and Simon, and I paid them all back except Simon, who refuses to let me pay him back the 600 quid because he'll always have it over me.
Yeah. I've still got him where I want him.
So I always owe Simon 600 quid.
Can you say what the TV stuff was that you...
Oh, it's just like special drama shows and stuff. Like things that, you know... That,
not the bill with the other Nick Frost.
No, like sort of like kind of like, you know, like TV drama stuff. The things that would have been good to do, but like... I knew that if I said yes, then I was basically taking my eye off the ball and Sean wouldn't happen. But I was really, like, seriously in the red, and I was having to move out of my flat, and my landlord was really, like, sort of basically froze the rent. He actually reduced the rent because he felt I sort of... I told him I was moving, and he said, why? And I said, I couldn't afford to stay there anymore. So he took pity on me, and it actually reduced the rent.
It just shows how in some situations with this, you know, getting films made, you have to hold your nerve. And if you don't, then these chances slip by, and thank goodness you did.
No, and you know, this is something we'd already done Space and been, you know, nominated for BAFTAs for it and stuff, but it was still like sort of, that didn't necessarily guarantee that the film was going to be made at all.
I mean, Nick had gone back to serving tables between the first and second series of Space. I mean, we were still, I think we just...
Did he do that after the second series of Space?
No,
as well?
He did it between... Oh yeah, I think he probably did do a bit of waiting after second series.
Yeah.
It was, it was all very... touch and go, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And then when we did it.
Yeah.
Well, did you guys not know you were getting the second series in between? I thought...
No, we decided to do the film, or we had the idea for the film during the first series, and it's, I guess, spoke about it at length. We did the second series.
And then we started writing it.
And then we started writing it, because at that point we didn't want to do a third series. The second series was very tough to make. It was it was very ambitious, and we didn't have many resources, and it so used to give us headaches every day. And as fun as it was tough, and we thought, let's try something else. And that was Shaun of the Dead. So
so when Shaun was put in the turnaround, And you guys were, did you pitch it to Working Title and other people, or was it just Working Title?
Yeah, we did. The funny thing is that Working Title was one of the, I think I went in there on my own, like maybe even between Spaced 1 and 2, and vaguely talked about our idea to Natasha Wharton, who worked there at the time. And I think because I was maybe, there was something, I was definitely nervous about Working Title because they were the biggest company that I sort of didn't really want to get, I didn't want to get a no from the biggest company.
Yeah.
So I think I sort of deliberately half-assed the interview. And at that time, it was called Tea Time with the Dead. I remember we had like a one-page like Word document with the vague ideas. And then when we were doing the second series, then the ideas started to come together more. And I think we were also, when we talked about it, we were trying to sort of define what it is by saying what it wasn't. And there were like, we didn't want it to be like, it's funny because as much as people say, oh, it's like Evil Dead or it's like Brain Dead, it isn't really. Like, there's some things that carry over, but those films are much more kind of like stylized and even cartoony. And in a way, we wanted to make it feel a bit more kind of real and naturalistic. And the comedy be naturalistic and the sort of the creeping threat feel more sort of real in a way.
Yeah. And at this point,
so
we had
a slightly
no
different
idea.
Tone, you know?
Yeah, we had no idea about 28 Days Later or the Dawn of the Dead remake.
But I remember you called me to tell me about 28 Days Later and I went mental.
Yeah, yeah. Because as far as we knew, it was like, no one's done this for such a long time. We've been inspired because of Resident Evil and they'd really captured that sort of, you know, that classic zombie, and it had reignited our love from our childhood. And so that's what I... And we thought, oh my God, no one's done zombies for ages. This feels so ripe for reinvention. And then suddenly it felt there was this collective subconscious thing going on. Even though Danny's film is not a zombie film, and he always maintains that it's not a zombie film. The Dawn of the Dead one, very much, with the title and that.
and all that,
coming out a week. But we seemed like the most sort of on the nose to the you know, uninformed observer. We looked like a really quick... parody.
It's funny, I told James Gunn recently, because I'd never told him, that we actually got hold of a copy of the Dawn of the Dead remake script to make sure there was no overlap. And the one thing that there was overlap then didn't end up in their film, and we cut it out of ours as well. So there was one, there was one joke that was in his script, because a lot of his script wasn't in the actual finished film, that we had in our film, and we cut it out.
Which one was it?
It was the jogging zombie.
Of course.
That we had one thing that was you saw a zombie jogger, and then later he was the only one that was running.
Yeah, we had a running zombie in the script. That's right.
But just one.
It was because he was all he did in life was jog, so he was able to run.
His
in
muscle
death.
Memory.
Yeah, that's right.
But it wasn't in either film in the end.
No, it became Chris Dickens running from a zombie
in
the walk across to the shop, didn't it?
Yeah.
He turned up in World War Z, I think. was Hot Fuzz floating around at that point? Was there the seeds of that? Because obviously you have the paintball sequence in Spaced, which is, you're obviously loving doing the action stuff in that.
Not really. I mean, it was something that like I had thought about doing something with it before Shaun of the Dead, in terms of like, I did like the idea of doing a rural cop film. And so I guess it was probably sort of lurking in the back of my mind a little bit, but definitely it wasn't something that we even talked about until we'd done Shaun. I mean, it's funny now, and you know, it's nice to be given credit for like sort of the idea of like a sort of a 10-year plan, because people say, when you were back in Shaun of the Dead, were you planning like all these references or like callbacks and stuff in World's End? It's like, no, we were just happy that we were making a film. And it wasn't really until even it came out in the UK that we even knew it was going to get released in the rest of the world. In fact, it was going to go straight to video in the States, like until it came out in the UK, and then when sort of people on the internet started kind of buzzing about it, then it got a theatrical release. No, it's fair to say that the internet like interest in the States by that website, that Ain't It Cool, got it a release in the US. I think if it hadn't been that, it might have just gone straight to. But it wasn't until then we started thinking about the next film. And I think, Simon, you were a little bit resistant to the cops idea initially.
Well, yeah, because I think Shaun of the Dead had been such a kind of... it was such a sort of collaborative germ, whereas the germ of Hot Fuzz was very much Edgar, and I had nothing better to bring to the table, so I felt like, okay, I'll go along with this idea. And it took me a little while to kind of find the love for it in the writing process, but I think once we started doing...
Once you started training.
Once I started getting fit, yeah. No, we started doing research with the cops, which, you know, at first I was like, oh, man, you've got to work. And then they started to tell us these amazing stories in it. And we went off on a little trip, didn't we, to a bunch of different constabularies. And that was fascinating. And it started to take shape for me So by the time we came to shoot it, it was, you know, I was fully 100% sort of into it and ready for it as well, because I got in shape.
Yeah, it was, I mean, even though it was something where there's an element, all three of the movies are personal. You know, the sort of Sean one is the most obvious because it's a character living in North London about to turn 30. In Hot Fuzz, you know, we've never been cops, and yet we are both from, like, the west of England. So yeah. It was something about where we, a film about where we had grown up, and lots of those aspects of it come into it, and all of the, you know, the supermarket stuff and stuff about Freemasons is all kind of from personal experience in a way. But the thing that was interesting was doing the research was really interesting, but also, you know, we did a lot more kind of like groundwork than we had to do with Sean, which is basically just coming straight from our brain. And I did remember once, this time I think we wrote in Big Talk on Great Titchfield Street, but I do remember time we were having a particularly tough day, especially trying to work out like the Agatha Christie style plot, which we give major credit to Agatha Christie for making it look easy when it's not easy.
Yeah.
But I do remember one time you like banging your head against the wall and just going, I just want to be in front of the camera. Like Simon just gave up. For like, and that, so for free, like, it would be like, and it's, you know, like, I think actually out of the three scripts, The World's End was the most fun to write, or was the one where it had been like sort of in our brains for so long that when we actually turned on the tap, it just came all
and also
out,
Hot Fuzz was very much that difficult second album, you know. We kind of like the initial draft for Hot Fuzz was about 185 pages long, and it became like we didn't have the leanness or the economy of Shaun of the Dead. It was this great big sprawling, very complicated.
That was because we'd written in all the ITV2 breaks.
Yeah, true.
We'd written in all the adverts and bumpers.
It wasn't on today.
It was weird. It was a few days it wasn't on.
I've written to my MP to complain.
But we, you know, we sort of did this big splurge, and then we had to edit and edit and edit, and it was a much more strenuous sculpting of the first draft down to something a little leaner. Mm. Whereas The World's End was pretty much, because we'd learned from that experience, The World's End was, the first draft of it is very, very similar to what you see on the screen.
Yeah, when we made The World's End, we actually wrote a script, and we said no. I always have this bet with Eric Fellner of whether the assemble edit is going to be under 2 hours long. Because usually assemble edits are crazy long. Like sort of like an assemble edit for like a 2 hour movie can be 4 hours long. Mm. And the Sean like assemble edit was under 2 hours, and the World's End one was. So I usually have a bet with Eric Fellner about whether it'll be under that. The assemble edit for Hot Fuzz though was 2¾ hours long. And so obviously that came massively down. But it was something, especially when you're kind of like up against it budget-wise, like it's a good thing to kind of, you know, just plan to have everything in the movie, or like there's nothing that can really be cut out, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that was one thing that we've sort of always done is come to set with a script and with stuff to shoot and never anything to figure out on the day. Mm. I mean, maybe a little bit of blocking here and there. Once you get into the set, things might change. But we have a lot of rehearsal time where we make sure that anything that might slow us down on the day is dealt with, so we come to set with a film to shoot. You know, I always marvel at people who come to set and go, okay, what are we going to do that? Because you just think, oh my God, you can hear the money just ticking away. And it just helps our style if we know exactly what we're doing.
But your scripts are so intricate. I mean, you know, there's even a bit on the World's End making of where you, not rail against necessarily, but you do say that you don't want to be like certain American comedies where you turn up on set and just improvise the entire thing. And not that improvisation on your sets is a four-letter word necessarily, but it is certainly something that you discourage, or because you seem to be very prepared and fairly.
I think it's just because the scenes, I hope, are quite tight in terms of each line leads on to the next. I mean, that's it, is that I don't think you could, like that scene with the pronouns, like you couldn't improvise that because it's sort of too, there's too many rapid-fire interjections and each. The main thing is each line is leading on for the next. Because for the most part, and I've got nothing against kind of improvised films, because whether it's Robert Altman or the Judd Apatow approach, when it works, it's like gold. But the downside to it, when you see bad ones, is it's just all arguments. Because that's the only thing you can really improvise, is like, you think this, you think that, go at it. Mm. That's the only thing you can really like do.
And even like kind of,
and even like Curb Your Enthusiasm is designed like that. You know, if you see one of the scripts for that show, it's kind of fascinating where they have the scenario and they just kind of like argue around it and stuff and get to the plot point. But I think we just like, well, one is that the films are really ambitious, and so we're incredibly meticulous in terms of I was going to say anal. We're very meticulous.
We're getting back to that place. Yes.
I think that's £80.
It wasn't called anal.
Wait, what's that called? There's a name for it, isn't there?
Anal talk.
French polishing? Is that one that
was? No, French polishing is the other one.
Let's not go about that.
Okay, don't worry.
I think it's one thing that I've just had this epiphany. One of the key films that Edgar and I cite as an influence on us is Raising Arizona. And when I watched that film, when I was a kid, I realized that the directorial style of the movie was almost like a character in the film. So it was like the way that the camera moved and the way that the Coens used the camera to be funny. It was like another presence, and it was like another character. And I think that's the thing with our films, is that Edgar's directorial style has the presence of a character. And if one person's improvising in a scene, then everyone has to improvise. And that character can't improvise because it's so strict, you know? Yeah. So we have to be in line with Edgar's directorial style. And that's not a burden on us. It helps us enormously. But it means that all the transitions are very tight, all the dialogue can echo, we can plan stuff out a lot, we can do a lot of foreshadowing, a lot of paying off, and it's just a more satisfying kind of structural adventure than just kind of making it up. Some people can do that, and they do it really well. Seth Rogen's guys dab hands at it, and it's a different style of comedy and one that I really enjoy, but it doesn't work for what we do.
Did he do that much on Paul? Seth.
Improv. Well, interesting enough, we messed around in rehearsals, and then Joe Latrulio, who did a lot of Paul's lines on set, he did improv, which then Seth recreated to make it sound like he was making up on the, because obviously you can't have a CGI character improvise. But we wanted to see if that would happen.
Not yet, anyway.
That's another. No, look at Edgar, he's scowling.
Do you have to tell actors going in that there's not going to be any improv? Do you sometimes get people who are a bit surprised by it?
The only times I've had, I think because the script is pretty tight, people stick to it. I don't think you really have too many times people have gone off. The only time I've noticed that is sometimes actually is more when I was doing Scott Pilgrim, I would do auditions with actors and they would like improvise on top of it. But the only thing they do is add extra swearing. And you would sort of like be...
A very actor thing to do there.
Yeah, just add extra fucks. And so you're thinking, well, it is a PG-13, so that's not going to fly. I mean, in our film, there's already swearing in it, so people don't feel the need. But I've noticed that on other auditions, that sort of like the main thing that actors contribute when they're improvising is just extra swearing.
That's because subconsciously you feel like it's going to make you funnier if you swear, so you do it as a means of trying to, get approval.
Yeah, but Alison Jones, who's an amazing casting director, it happened so frequently. It was almost my bugbear. I said, why does everybody... And it was always actors, never actresses. It's always actors adding F-bombs to everything. Yeah. And one time, while somebody was actually, after I'd complained about it a couple of times, she had this kind of clipboard, and while somebody was talking and they started doing it, she kind of held it up so I couldn't see it and then put it down. And after the guy went red and then fumbled the rest of the audition. And then as soon as he left, I said, I know what's written on that piece of paper. And she looked at it up and said, please don't swear. Which was amazing. But I think people that come in to like work with us, I think, just, they try and just make the most of the part that they're given and stuff.
Well, we usually the guys that, we had this incredible group of actors for Hot Fuzz. We wanted the film to be in a sort of Agatha Christie vein, peppered with stars, so that you made it was easy for you to remember the characters. When you have a lot of characters, if they're famous, you remember them. It's more easy to remember them. And so we got this wonderful group of older actors who it was just a joy every day to work with them. And I think they really appreciated the structure. They when you get young people, they come in and they want to mess around. It's comedy. They want to do their thing. They're the harder ones to deal with. But anyone who's an actor and who appreciates the structure of a script is quite happy to, have it all there for you, because it means it's easier in a way. I think this whole improv thing has come from, it's relatively new when it comes to comedy. People think, oh, that's how you do comedy. You make it up. No, it's not.
Yeah, but which is not to say that you're not completely closed to that sort of thing, because I know, for example, that you take a lot on in the rehearsal period and you give the scripts to Nick Frost and... He'll input, you'll take his input on board.
If a funny joke comes out of the rehearsal, it'll be in the movie. Like, I think there's a couple of, Smashy Smashy Eggman, I think, came out of the rehearsal.
That was mine, wasn't it?
I think it was, you and... It was a sort of, a 1-2. Especially you and Nick together or something kind of came... Yeah.
Yeah, that's... God, that's lovely.
Well, Nick's not here, so let's say it's yours.
You did Smashy Smashy. He did Eggman.
I think, it's that thing of, let's see what is thrown up when we start, because we both, Martin, Paddy, Eddie, they're all such sort of inventive guys, and Nick has always been our secret weapon. So we're never not gonna. We're not tyrants, you know. We don't come and go, this is what you're gonna say. We have time to for stuff to come up, and funny stuff comes up, and we laugh a lot. And then if it really works, then we'll put it into the script. It's just that when we get to the set, that's when it sort of like locks, and that's when we have to kind of abide by what's there, because otherwise it'll cause problems. Mm. So yeah, we're always up for you know, riding other people's coattails if they come out funny lines and claiming that it was theirs on podcast.
Who came up with which title? I think you guys do great titles, particularly Hot Fuzz, which I think is an amazing title. Who came up with that?
I think that was you, wasn't it? But you wanted it to be Double T.
Yeah, we disagreed on for a long time, and Simon was, of course, correct. Is I wanted it to spelt with two T's.
So and I think I said like, to you, sort of do you like, want for teen slang. In Q&As for the rest of our lives, people to go, why is there a second T?
I think we only, it was the Hot Fuzz was, I think that was always the top title, and the only other one was Blue Fury, but Hot Fuzz just sounded... It just like sort of jumped out.
I do say Blue Fury in the film, don't I?
Yeah.
I say bring down the Blue Fury.
What about the World's End?
World's End never had another title because it was kind of inspired by the pub itself. And in fact, I think even before we had the story fully locked down, I just used to think about that pub name, thinking it'd be great to do a film called The World's End that sort of revolves around this pub.
Because so we had history, and we all have history at that pub. The World's End in Camden. There are many World's Ends around the UK, and it's quite a common pub name, more common than you'd think. But we, Edgar and I, used to go there prior to going to the Odeon Camden, where we watched a lot of movies. Mm. I had my first date with my wife there, Nick.
Classy first date, son.
Yeah, classy. I said, "Well, I'll meet you at the World's End." Nick spectacularly fell off the wagon there once. A very memorable night.
Did he fall off the wagon as he was watching you have your first date with your future wife?
Yeah. That he was so depressed.
He's going, he's leaving me.
I'm losing him. but that pub kind of had resonance with us. And we'd shot the slow motion gunfight in space, which became one of the sort of key scenes in that series, was shot at the back of the World's End, you know,
in the alleyway. It's right by the Camden Tup. You can, if you walk out of the one side of the World's End, you can see the alley.
Yeah,
you know.
So it was always at the end of the alley for us. Weirdly,
the last time we had been to the World's End until recently was the first night that Shaun of the Dead opened, because we went to sneak in. Me, you, Naira, and Chris Dickens went in at the midnight showing, 10:30 showing, or something like that.
Yeah.
And we went to the World's End before, but that was until recently when we had some sort of wrap drinks at the World's End. That was the last time I'd actually been there.
Toilet still smell.
At one point, wasn't there a World's End poster above the World's End sign?
No, that was for something else. That was for Brandon Generator. They had a poster above.
Of course,
yes.
I was just going to ask about titles. I read that Spaced was going to be called Lunched Out at one point.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
It was a Brighton expression. It was Jess's, and she. It was. It meant kind of like if you're a bit lunched out. It was. But it sounded too much like
advertising executives
kind of thing. Right. And Spaced just felt like it had so many meanings, you know, and it was my idea. And I'm taller than Jess.
I know, that's the thing, is that there's no other title for The World's End, because otherwise you could have Lunched Out, Tea Time of the Dead, Blue Fury, but there is no alternative.
That's an alternative Cornetto trilogy.
Yeah,
Tea Time of the Dead, Blue Fury, and...
But there is no other title for The World's End.
No, there isn't.
Never.
No.
In terms of the autobiographical input, there seems to be a lot of you in The World's End, Edgar, but what about you, Simon? Is there a lot drawn from your experiences in the movie?
Yeah, there's a lot of me in The World's End, and, you know, a lot of it is it's probably something I'll never talk about. It's kind of, you know, I totally relate to Gary. I know people who are like Gary, and there's a lot of a personal investment in Gary King for me. I love Gary. A lot of people say, oh, Gary's a pain, but he's not. He's in pain, you know, and I think that was that my route to playing him was to not think, oh, he's a dick, you know, is to love him and kind of realize that he's driven by quite dark forces and dark impulses which govern his decisions, you know. And he's kind of, it's not that he's selfish and horrible, he's unwell, and that makes him that way, you know. And so it was kind of something that I just wanted to go into seriously and play him, you know. I've had experience with people like that, and I didn't want to. Greg Hempel from Still Game, very funny Scottish comic. We were talking on Twitter today, and he said something about, just because you make light of something doesn't mean you think lightly of something. And I think that really goes for this movie. You know, it has a very serious core.
Yeah, I think the thing is that, I mean, you know, we think that like Gary's heart is in the right place at the start. He genuinely wants to get the gang back together, but then as soon as he realizes he can't have that because they're adults and they're all different, he starts to kind of like you know, deviate from the plan in various destructive ways.
Yeah.
But I think he definitely wants to. All he wants is to be with his teenage friends again. But he can't
Gary,
have that. He can't have that when they're 40.
Yeah. All Gary wants to be is happy, and that's what his quest really is for happiness, and that's why, despite everything at the end, he's kind of happy, you know, and that's why he's quit drinking, because he was always the reason he drank was because it was the only thing that either distracted him from the fact that he was unhappy or gave him a very brief amount of happiness, you know.
A few people get in touch with
you. Spoiler alerts for people. Right. We haven't seen it. Back up.
As we call
just put like a klaxon earlier. Yeah. Again.
I imagine they've seen the movies if they're listening to this. If they're not, more fool them. But have you had people from, say, alcoholism support groups come up to you and talk about the film and talk about its impact?
Yeah, there's been some amazing things written online about it, actually, and about how it... it's a vindication for us, because we weren't taking these things lightly, but for people to understand what it's saying about addiction and about, you know, the kind of the selfishness of that illness and stuff. And the worst thing it would be if people went, oh, that's not very nice, does not be funny that, because essentially the film, you know, again, spoiler alert, is always thought it was a funny thing that it was a film about a sort of suicide on the run from a psychiatric hospital. It doesn't sound like the log line for a comedy, but
we wanted it to be like that. The film is basically Gary runs away from his intervention at the start, and he sort of has a second intervention from the friends at like the half hour mark, where they all turn on him and sort of send some hard truths to his face. So that's the intervention number two, and then intervention number three is the network, which is a cosmic intervention.
Yeah, and it's all
and
in
so
a sort
you
of
know
circle.
Even that they're in a circle, like they're in an encounter kind of group at the end. Mm. That was the idea, and it was that thing. And if you notice throughout the movie that like sort of Gary only really opens up when he's one on one with somebody, either like whether it's with the teen in the bathroom, who he's much more confessional and honest to, with Nick, with Rosamund. But when there's any, so even the final scene in The World's End, where it's like sort of Gary and Andy together and like lots of, realities come kind of flooding out. As soon as he's then in front of the network and the whole town, he kind of like puts
his armor back on
and starts, you know, being the sort of the bluffing kind of bullshitter, legend, you know.
There's a nice moment that I really love, that I'm really proud of in the scene when Gary follows Sam into the toilet for the first time, and she asks him what happened, and it's preceded by one of our favourite jokes in the script, which is about the Gary's explanation of why the disabled is out of order. But afterwards she says, no, what happened to you? And it's like, the way that we played that, Roz and I, was that Gary doesn't expect to be skewered like that. And you see it in his face very briefly that she's, oh, fuck, she's seen me.
She's on to me.
She's on to me, you know, and you see him, you see him panic for a split second. And it's lovely. And I'm glad the takes Edgar used were really well chosen, because you just see it for a second.
But to answer your question as well, like one of the things that was amazing online, there was a couple of things, and one was this article by that guy, film critic Holt, which is really kind of in-depth, where he sort of said that in watching the film that it made him come to terms with the fact that he has an alcohol problem in a way. And then reading the comments on that article was amazing, because a lot of people felt a similar way, is that they said, I remember this in the credits, said most depictions of on-screen alcoholism are about like redneck, wife-beating, southern, like sort of, drunks. And to see somebody who is more of a sort of a social functioning alcoholic is something that's a bit more close to home for a lot of people. So I mean, the thing is with these movies, and this is why when you read like the log line, you know, on the back of the DVD, goes hilarious gut busting fun, there is a Trojan horse element with these movies, in the same way that, like, you know, you wouldn't sell Shaun of the Dead on the scene where Shaun shoots his mother in the head, and in the same way with World's End, that there's like sort of like, I never like to use the word dark, because dark sounds like you're sort of striving for effect, and it's more the thing of being honest.
Yeah.
So there's sort of maybe an honesty that comes out of it. But we like to, there's an element of Trojan horse tactics with these movies, is that you kind of like make a sci-fi comedy, but you smuggle in a more personal film in amongst it. Mm. The kind of film that you wouldn't actually be able to make otherwise. Do you know what I mean?
No, absolutely.
It's the sort of film, and even if you did, nobody would go and see it, you know. So it's a very nice thing for us to actually. And one of the things we're most proud of these three films is that we've managed to talk about our upbringing or like our lives through like three wildly different genres. Even Hot Fuzz is like, you know, as we've kind of talked about a lot on the commentaries, is a lot more personal. Even though it's ridiculous, it's a ridiculous movie, there's lots of like things that have come from our lives that are in that movie. So That's one of the greatest things about doing these films is that sort of like we're able to put so much of ourselves in there. Because it's that weird thing is when screenwriters, when you have that kind of thing from like screenwriting teachers, they say, write what you know. And we have done that, but with a zombie film, a cop film, and an invasion film. And that's absolutely right. Is that everything in there is from our lives. We've been there. We've been those characters.
Yeah. But going back to Gary, I mean, Gary for me is such a bold undertaking. And I do know some people who've seen the film who did have problems with Gary, and I'm sure you've had that yourselves. I'm sure if you'd made this under the studio system, I know you have Universal on board this, you would have had a lot more notes to dampen him down and to soften the edges. Did you have anything like that when you were making it? Because you really commit to this character.
Yeah, actually, we have a great support network around us. You know, Eric Fellner, who is ostensibly our kind of boss that we answer to, is always... You know, he'll give us notes and stuff, but he trusts us implicitly. And we really wanted to not wuss out with Gary, you know, and not necessarily redeem him particularly, just have him go on a journey. But, you know, we wanted him to be the villain as much as the hero of the movie. That was a really interesting idea of having this guy be simultaneously, you know, evil and good, you know. And I really wanted to just test the audience into sympathizing with him, you know, and kind of to the point where when you reveal what's really going on with Gary, that if you don't sympathize with him, you might think, oh, maybe I was a bit hasty, you know. and what happens to him eventually in the film is kind of, I think it's sort of positive, even though the ending was willfully divisive. We wanted it. We didn't want to pussy out on the title of the movie. And we wanted to give the audience something to think about when they left and chew over, and not for it all to be the status quo returned. And, you know, because that's the worst thing you can do in a movie, is you upset people's kind of expectations for a little while, then you put everything back together neatly and they walk away and they forget the film in a couple of days, a couple of hours. You know, this we wanted people to just kind of wanted to poke people in the ribs with it a bit, you know.
But there's also, I think, sort of the idea of the ending is that it's kind of, we think it's the happiest ending of the three in a way. Even though, like, sort of it's it sucks for Earth, the five characters have found some kind of like personal happiness. And in a way, I think sort of like quite a few people have that, like, even in the back of their mind, have that kind of off the grid fantasy about, like, you know, what would happen if you just kind of like, you know, Macs and cell phones went completely. And in a way, like, the characters all thrive, you know, like Andy has become the hunter-gatherer, you know, he's back with his wife, Peter has got together with Sam and is like sort of living the kind of like the pioneer life.
Steve.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. What happened to the fitness instructor? She's 26. Did she survive?
He never wanted her.
Yeah.
She survived, I'm sure.
She's 26 forever.
She hid under a Pilates machine. But we kind of the idea that we had very early on, we went away to Cowley Manor when we devised the story and we came up with the whole idea of the network. And I remember the first thing in the network that we said, it was like Facebook in space. It was like this kind of network that everyone belonged to, and, you know, Earth was being dragged into it. But one of the key things, in the same way that we always wanted Shaun to end up with Ed in the shed at the end of Shaun of the Dead, that ending preceded the majority of the writing. You know, that's where we wanted to get to. We wanted Gary to be with his young friends again in a sort of darkly ironic thing. And originally it was time travel, wasn't it? But we realized that was a...
It was like a sort of... It was too big a third act thing. It wasn't like we didn't have the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
As we wanted to have
like
the
cheating,
movie and then like them go back in time to sort of like 88. But then it felt like sort of... It was a bit too like sort of... It just felt like too late to introduce that. And if you're going to make a film about time travel, it may as well be the entire film.
Hot pub time machine.
Yeah. Well, in fact, in a weird way, you know, strangely enough, like something like that, as soon as I saw the trailer for that film, I said, let's not do time travel. You know, let's ditch that. And it was already what we had. It was almost too similar to something like Back to the Future 2 anyway, the idea of going back and being in the prologue. So, but then it actually sort of helped inspire then what was the main thrust of it, is that the blanks themselves can become the fountain of youth. So what Gary really wants is to be 18 again. And yet, when he's given the chance to be in his 18-year-old body, he rejects it. So that's Gary's first kind of, like, progressive move, is to literally kill his younger self. He has a chance. This is what he's wanted all the time, is to be 18 again. And yet, when he's given the chance to be in Thomas J. Law's body...
And who wouldn't? I'd love to be in Thomas J. Law.
he you know, kind of like rejects it.
So and of
it
course, was, that's another kind of irony as well. In that, you know, Garrett, you discover, and this is obviously completely spoilerific now at this podcast, but there we go. We can't hang on to that forever. You know, Gary has tried to kill himself, and then, you know, 10 minutes after you found out that he literally does kill himself on screen, but it's just not himself that he kills. You know, he kills that part of himself. Yeah. And it's interesting, and a little, and it's something that we were so pleased with when we actually reshot the very last sequence in the bar, because we just wanted to tweak it. And I was actually shooting something else in which I was clean shaven. And we were talking about, oh, no, what are we going to do about that? And we suddenly realized it was better if Gary was clean-shaven, because it was like he was looking as young as he possibly could with his young friends, and it was a physical change for him. You know, he'd sort of he'd smartened up a little bit. And so when he pulls down his mask, it's like he's all clean-shaven. And
yeah,
it worked really well because it was looked like he'd changed, you know.
Yeah, prior to that, like, we'd done almost identically the same scene for the ending, except he had a beard and it had slightly less dialogue. And we just wanted to kind of be, you know, a bit more explicit in a way. So that's where his little monologue that recalls back to the first post and refers to the Three Musketeers. Because crucially, the things that he does in terms of it being like two steps back for the whole world, but one step forward for Gary, is that he's not drinking and he's sticking up for his friends. The key thing he does in that end scene is stick up for his friends. So it's very easy to get rid of that time travel idea when we realize, oh, what we want is already there. Like, if you have the young clones, that's who he's with at the end. He's not with, like, his teenage friends. He's with, like, the clones of his teenage friends. So he has his band of brothers. And also because we kind of, like, not to get too sort of deep into it, you know, we thought that maybe, like, most of Gary's problems come from kind of, like, an absent father. And so the idea that the Blanks are orphans is that he switches allegiances to them. Like, he's now the king of the Blanks because they're all orphans. They've been, like, completely neglected and kind of abandoned by their father, the voice of Bill Nye. Yeah. And so they need somebody to lead them. So we like the idea that Gary now becomes the leader of the Blanks. He's going to sort of take on the orphans and become like, you know, like a gothy Fagin.
Amazing.
Gothy Mad Max. I'm just curious whether you've had people write university dissertations about any of your films, because you wrote about films at Bristol.
I did, yeah. Yeah, I have, absolutely. People, I always have one eye on, when we write, that what people will say about the films, you know, and what they will reflect in terms of what's going on in our heads socially and what have you. And I hope we've given people some meat to chew on, you know, and interpret. And because there's loads of stuff. Like, I was thinking the other day, you could look at Gary, and it's ironic in a way, I guess. No, it's not ironic. You can look at Sean, Nicholas, and Gary as all, because Sean is an orphan. Sean's father died. I think probably Nicholas Angel's father was slightly absent, and he relied on his uncle, who betrayed him in the end. And Gary's father didn't care about him. So you've got three characters who are all essentially abandoned in some way by their fathers. And you know, my dad left. I have a great relationship with my dad, but he left when I was 7. I'm sure something of that went into the writing. You know, my own view of, I had a bad relationship with my stepdad. That whole thing about he's not my dad in Shaun of the Dead was kind of came from reality. So I think as a university student, you could definitely do a thesis on, you know, abandonment, paternal trauma, and the Cornetto trilogy, you know, in 10,000 words.
Is that whole
that runs through all three of them, is the notion of being a lone voice against a sort of homogenizing force. You've got the zombies, the NWA, and the network are all these forces of kind of collective change, which our heroes are standing against, you know.
I think it's that thing, is though, and I think all of them have that, you know, the arrested development thing, but also kind of like a fear of growing up. Like, I think Sean has that, Gary has that, like, Danny has that in Hot Fuzz. That's where that sort of comes from, is like Danny doesn't want to really face the realities of life.
Well, Nicholas Angel has it to the point where he enforces it on himself so completely he has to force himself to loosen up in order to win the day, you know, to dumb down a little bit.
But, you know, and things like, I find that I'm sort of like, the big element of Gary that's me is that thing of like, being overly nostalgic and also wanting to recreate things. Like, I feel like sort of, maybe the film was actually therapeutic in sort of like dealing with it in some way, but I always used to think about the parts and going back and doing things again. Never wanting to do things that I did well again, but just wanting to go and Groundhog Day my own life all the time.
Yeah.
And I spend a bizarre amount of time thinking about it. And you kind of thinking, well, I feel like I'm reasonably happy in the present. So why do I spend so much time thinking about it? So it was, this is kind of like the movie was sort of about that, about trying to sort of, the dangers trying to recapture former glories, you know?
You talked a lot about how this movie was inspired by the idea of going back to your hometown and finding that it's completely changed while you've been gone. But I wondered what it's like for you guys now, going back to your hometowns now, that you're well known. Do people treat you differently? Does it feel like maybe when you were going back after going to university, that must feel different from what it does now?
Well, I sort of had that experience like sort of very vividly because Hot Fuzz was shot in my hometown. So I'd only done like Shaun of the Dead then, so it wasn't like, and I'm not like in front of the camera anyway, but it was kind of funny when, I mean, it was definitely a bittersweet experience. It was mostly great, but there's that weird thing where one of the things that sort of inspired the movie in a way is that when we were shooting Hot Fuzz and we'd set Sanford as supposed to be this idyllic sort of pastoral kind of haven, and yet since I've been away there was now like a Starbucks right in the middle of shot. So something like, oh, that didn't actually fit Sanford, so we actually had to digitally erase it from the movie.
Wow.
And so there's like chains that like you realize that sort of like when you go to London you think, oh, London's like a metropolis and it's all chains, and then when you go back to the country thinking, oh, all high streets look the same. It's kind of like just, it's that homogeny. But I think sort of, so it's a bittersweet experience going back, because if you've moved away for work, like, you know you can't stay in your hometown, but I think there's always that sort of slight
also,
guilt about going away and
yeah, as a director though, because you're known, you know, because you spend most of your time, all of your time behind the camera, there though, you're very known because you're the boy that did well from Wells, you know, so for you to go back there, it's the same for me. If I go, I don't really go out into Gloucester now. When I go home, I go to my mum's and I stay indoors because everyone kind of knows, because there's always bits in the local paper about you. So even if people don't know what you've done, they know about you because you're the guy from here that went on and did that. Was in the film.
Yeah. When I was
I don't go out.
When we were shooting a scene in Hot Fuzz, I was, what was a funny, so occasionally you'd see sort of like people you went to school with or teachers and stuff. And there was this girl that I don't think I even went out with her. I think I got off with her once at a party. For the US readers, got off means kissing, making out. I know, sort of got off is not a phrase. I know you have lots of American listeners, right? They don't know the phrase
do,
got
yeah.
off.
You made out
as
with
I
her.
Find out to my peril.
Where is that, and for American listeners, where is that in terms of bases? Where is that? Is that first base?
First base.
First base, okay.
But so this is, so we're outside the news agent filming a scene, and some kid comes up to me with the Shaun of the Dead DVD and goes, oh, can you sign my DVD? And just as I get the pen out, this girl comes around the corner and just goes, no, Edgar Wright, I don't want your autograph. And walks off.
Just as a measure of talking about your maturity when it comes to getting off with and making out. When we were doing the scene in the Mermaid, and Nick and Eddie and I were dancing with the marmalade sandwich. When I was making out with Rose Reynolds, every time we'd do a snog, Edgar would go, behind the camera. It was so distracting.
I don't think I'd really done. I think that's weirdly like the heaviest kind of sex scene I've ever done. Like,
well, we were trying. Me and Rose were trying to get like a line of spit to kind of connect us, and it was just Edgar's vocal disgust every time.
Just as well you didn't do Blue's the Warmest Color. Have you found you're getting recognised a lot more between Shaun of the Dead and now? Are people, the places you can't go without getting mobbed? How does that work?
No, I'm not so much sure. I mean, I get recognised by people who watch extras on DVDs. So it's nice. I usually sort of like,
you get recognised by people who know what you do. That's great. That's good. It's a nice way. It's not just, you.
I like when people call you Shaun of the Dead, like cabbies go, oh, it's Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah.
Have you had a tattoo of yourself done? Because people tweet you guys pictures of yourselves as tattoos, right?
I've had more than one person like tattoo my signature onto them, which I find some girl like a Scott Pilgrim signing in Toronto got the DVD signed and asked me to sign her tummy, and then at the screening like 4 hours later she goes, look, and pulled up her like midriff, and it was very strange, and I hope it's healed or you got rid of it since, but like seeing like your name in like sort of bloody raw, recently tattooed,
she
like
probably did it with herself and a pin and a biro.
But I sort of, I felt, I was, my reaction was completely honest. It goes, why did you do that? In that high-pitched voice. If you're listening out there, I hope it's
healed.
I imagine you've had a lot.
Yeah.
There's lots of Sean tattoos
all the time,
for sure.
Yeah. Because Sean's become a sort of, you know, in terms of people who are like horror fans and stuff. It's, I don't know. I've seen lots and lots, and it's quite strange. And I'm always grateful and perplexed by it, but I've got a whole bunch of pictures on my phone and people have sent me, and it's like, wow, that's such a commitment, you know. I'm gonna be on your body after I'm dead, probably. You know, it's kind of it's very, very strange.
Are you sure about this decision? Do you really want to do this?
Nick and I were in New Mexico, and this guy came out and said, can you sign my arm? And exactly the same thing. He said I'm gonna get this tattooed, just mine and Nick's sort of like scrawled signatures on his arm. But oh God, I mean, what an amazing thing! And
I have ITV2 tattooed on my back.
On your eyeballs.
I have one more quick question. You can get a Shaun of the Dead action figure. Why can't you get a blank action figure?
That would be perfect.
Maybe there will be one. I'd like to see somebody do an action figure of like Nick, like with his still hands.
I think we should try and get, because who was it? NECA did the and also Sideshow did one. And but I'd love to see a, because I also thought Nicholas Angel was a great action figure because he had so many different, you know, you could have him in Cycle Cop and you could have him in Riot Gear, and you know, and I think Gary and the gang would make great action figures. And the blanks, we always kind of said that part of the reason that the blanks came apart the way they did was like, you know, the more these guys regress into their sort of childhood selves, which is what happens when they start to get drunk, they become like they were, their life becomes like childhood, you know, they're basically playing with these toys and they're covered in blue, which Edgar always cited as being like when you came home from school covered in ink. Yeah. It's like the more the night goes on, the more they are surrounded by their past in a weird way, and part of that is the fact that the blanks are like action figures, you know.
Yeah, I would always have, like, at the end of a school day, inky hands, inky tongue, ink all down my shirt. I'd always
You're
have
doing
like,
it wrong,
blue
man.
Tongue, because I've been sucking my pen and it had leaked.
Blue is the warmest color.
It did not come from any lesbian antics, I'll tell you that.
Going back to how you guys ride together, you're in the same room at all times? Mm. You ever do that Skype thing?
We've had to, on occasion, by email maybe, but...
The cool thing is now what we do is, we always, one person writes, the other one paces around, but now we get the old HDMI cable and plug it into a big TV, and then you just have Final Draft up on the TV. So that's the cool thing to do, because then it's like, so before that it was always a bit like battleships. You'd sit opposite each other with your laptops facing each other, and one would always be peering over the other shoulder. Sometimes Final Draft has that screen share thing that never fucking works.
Yes, we tried that a few times. Then we had drop boxes and things, didn't we?
Yeah, but then like the advent of like just being able to plug the laptop into the TV is major, because now it's like we just have that up.
You can see it being written.
You can see it big, and whoever's typing can see what the other one's typing and go, no, you know.
So it used to be that we'd be over each other's shoulders or whatever, or like, oh yeah, the battleship thing. I wonder if they wrote battleship like that. There's no way that was written by two people. I say people. Yeah, we wrote a lot of this when we wrote in LA, because I was filming Star Trek Into Darkness, and Edgar, every day I wasn't on that, I'd go to Working Title LA, and we'd work in Eric Fellner's office, and he's got a lovely big plasma screen. So we had, the script was up on this big plasma screen, and it was very nice. And finally, we'd kind of arrived at this very ideal sort of setup, which was hugely conducive.
Do you run lines? Do you do dialogue out loud? And if so,
do you stick
to your character only, or do you do both?
Yeah, I do Gary, and you did everyone else. We actually, you know, we had a very clear idea of who we wanted in the script, and there was a version of the script that had like Eddie Marzan and Paddy Considine written in the script, Martin Freeman, so that we could hear their, you know, it helped us psychologically.
And in terms of getting those guys on board, though, did you have any struggles in a way getting them on board? Because I spoke to Paddy once and he about this movie, and he said that someone at the studio had said that he wasn't handsome enough to play the romantic lead. Is that
so full of shit?
No, that's true.
How can Paddy not be handsome enough?
I think to be fair, like they were thinking of him mostly in like Bourne Ultimatum,
right,
where he's kind of quite sort of downtrodden. Whereas the Paddy that we know, you don't often get to see on screen as much, which is kind of like handsome Paddy or handsome Paddy like cool, sort of doing confident. Like Northern Soul dancing in that Maloko video. So it's I think sort of like, to be fair to them, they were thinking of the Paddy Considine they see on screen who, you know, if you'd only seen Hot Fuzz and Born Automaton, you go, well, that guy, he's the handsome one.
But
he is in reality, and if you're listening to this, Paddy, you know you are. And in fact, his rap gift, like sort of like I had written on it, I said, you were awesome and handsome.
Martin but he's Freeman's a very like sort of, isn't he? He's difficult.
Martin Freeman's very difficult post Hobbit.
He's not a nice guy. It actually became a joke on set that like, because his last 18 months of life had been The Hobbit, you know. So every time, every frame of reference for him was The Hobbit. So every time he started speaking, he'd go, oh, when I was in it, we go, oh, shut up! And but there was a great night when we were filming out in Letchworth, and this sort of Brinks map van arrived full of, like, it was delivering to a bank. And Paddy said, fucking hell, Martin, your Hobbit residuals have arrived.
The main thing was, in terms of getting people to, like, Martin, and we really actually sort of, like, we were very lucky to get Martin at all, because it was important to us that Martin, everybody who's in the other two movies is in the third one. And those people are Simon, Nick, Bill Nighy, Rafe Spall, Martin Freeman, Julia Deakin, Patricia Franklin, and Kevin and Nick Wilson. I haven't left anybody out, have I?
Joe Cornish, but he wasn't, no.
Well, they're not in the speaking part. No. In the speaking part, yeah. So, because Joe doesn't have a speaking part in the first one, it was not very brief. I'm not in there. Oh, the other person is Garth Jennings.
Yes.
The two people who aren't in it is me and Joe Cornish. Like, you can hear my voice in World's End, and Joe isn't in it at all, but Garth Jennings is in there as well.
Where can we hear your voice?
I am in when he walks under the JCB and makes them drop all their bricks. You hear me go, oh, for fuck's sake!
There we go, I didn't know that.
That's me.
You have an actual cameo in Spaced, but you haven't appeared on screen in any of the movies.
No, I'm a zombie in Sean.
Falls over in some news.
Fall over in the final sequence.
I'm wrong, you're in all of them.
And then in Hot Fuzz, I'm very briefly in there as a shelf stacker in the background, wearing my old Gateway uniform. And I think it was on my birthday, actually.
Was it?
I think it was on my birthday. Maybe it was on my 32nd birthday or 33rd.
A birthday you share with Hitler.
Really?
I do, don't I?
Because you've talked about your days with your drama teacher, who obviously made an impact.
Yes.
So did you do acting back then? Were you into plays? And
I was in like theatre studies and stuff. I would be, if you see some of my amateur movies, I'm in it a lot more. Like, but I think sort of, I used to like doing that kind of stuff, but then, you know, like I'm not an actor. And when I'm asked to do part, I've told a very long story on another thing. I won't get into it. I was asked to be in the film Wolverine.
Really?
Which is true. Like sort of like it was.
As Wolverette.
As this little Wolverine Jr. I've got the hair, if not the body. I have not got the body. I do have the hair.
X-Men Origins but Wolverine or the Wolverine?
X-Men Origins Wolverine. And, you know, like, it was... I've told this story. I would refer you to, so I don't have to get into a 15-minute anecdote, on Kevin Smith's Smod Filmmakers or something. I can't remember what it's called. Smodcast.
Smodcast.
I tell this whole story. But, no, I have no aspirations to be an actor at all. And, like, Look Around You is kind of my limit.
You did the splits.
Yes. But like Look Around You is so easy because Look Around You is like they wanted to cast like non-actors essentially. Is most of the people in it they want to get kind of awkward performances. So I never had any aspirations to act.
It's funny, I feel the same way about directing. I would like to direct at some point, but Edgar almost keeps me from it because I think what's the point of doing it unless I have an understanding on a par with Edgar's. And Edgar's understanding of the medium. It has always been something
of the show medium.
has always been something that's kind of impressed me that on such a level that I'm like, well, if I can't do it like that, what's the point of doing it at all? But I'll eventually try. But I don't think I'll ever be as good as he was when he was 20.
I'll just stand behind Simon and say, your film will be, you'll be starring in it, and every scene will be a kissing scene. That'll be like, Simon's kissing a girl.
Could you ever direct Simon in a sex scene?
I don't know.
Nymphomaniac 2. How about you?
We can make up the poster.
I wish I play Edgar
Wright.
I don't think
I could direct Simon in a sex scene. No.
But weirdly enough, I went after The World's End. I went and I did another film with Rosamund, and we had quite a graphic sex scene in that movie. And I just remember thinking, I'm so glad Edgar's not here. Because it was both of us, you know.
That's my neighbour. And Tears of Rosamund Pike lives like one street away from me.
What has been the toughest shot to do in the trilogy?
I think, like, when we did Shaun of the Dead, we started with that long Steadicam show. It was the first day of the shoot, which is kind of a way of, like, really throwing down the gauntlet of, like, we're going to try something ambitious for the money and for, you know, like, sort of... So we start with that Steadicam show. Well, it's been something that's really... It's usually not necessarily shots. It's just usually the fucking weather. It's always the thing that, like, it's just, like, that's usually...
The record throwing sequence.
Yes.
The amount of times it was split up because of the weather.
Yes, but that was also, and credit to the DP, when he saw that location, he said, this is a bad idea because this face is north to south and you need some of the faces east to west. And I was like, it'll be all right. And then it's like, oh, I see why this is now a major problem.
Yeah.
Is there stuff with visual you could have done with visual effects back then that you wish you could go back?
Well, I was impressed by what we were able to do on The World's End. We maybe could have done a few more sort of missing heads and limbs with the zombies, but... Because it was amazing what we could do without a green screen on The World's End. But I'm happy with the way everything panned out, you know?
Yeah, I don't remember sort of something. I don't remember something that, like, usually it's something where, like, stunt stuff where you only have a number of, like, breakables and then that's it.
Yeah.
You know, that's usually the thing where it's like, it makes those sequences really highly charged because you only have maybe three takes at something or five takes at something. So that can be tough. But I'm trying to think of a sort of a particularly... It's usually scenes I remember, like, that was a tough scene. And there's usually, like, sort of things that we call, like, Black Wednesday or something. Like, the scene in World's End that was the hardest scene wouldn't seem like a very hard scene. It's the scene outside the mermaid when, like, everybody's leaving and they run into Martin Freeman. Mm. And they're talking about Bermuda Rhombus and the Aquanazis. It was... Martin Freeman had to leave to go to New Zealand the next day. So it was, like, a hard out... And we were going to lose him the next day. So we had to shoot this scene. We couldn't, like, restage it inside. And the night was a severe weather warning. It was literally on everybody's iPhones, that thing of, like, you know there's a severe weather warning. 100-mile-an-hour gale and, like, massive rainstorm.
It was, like, on Martin's reverses, it was really windy. On our reverses, it was really raining. On the side, on the wide, it was something else. And yet it cuts together beautifully. You don't notice.
But
it.
At the time, there'd be like the sort of like, I would be in the foulest mood. And like, so that's the thing. Is usually it's always the weather. And that's when you kind of think, fuck this country. Fucking weather. Like, I hate the fucking weather in this country.
You and Nick had a big Barney that night, I remember.
I'm when I'm moody, I'm terrible. And the worst thing that I do is I sort of like rely on my friendship with Simon and Nick way too much. I rely on them way too much to be like the cheerleaders. And like, strangely enough, like, you know, I didn't do that on Scott Pilgrim vs. the World because I didn't know the cast as well. So if I have a major failing, and I'll admit it, and I've said it to them as well, is that like, if I'm in a bad mood, I rely on Simon and Nick to kind of keep the crew happy, which is a bad thing. You've got to be the leader and you've got to keep kind of positive because it's not good for crew morale if you can see me like sort of rubbing my beard furiously and like looking dark and moody.
But we were very up against
it. I was just practicing for my scene in X-Men Origins Wolverine.
we're being wrapped up because we got to go to Q&A.
Oh, yeah.
At the Sydney World Hay Market. But I'll just ask very, very quickly, Edgar, what can you not tell us about Ant-Man?
I cannot tell you. I was thinking of a silly like title or something. Like Ant-Man. I don't know. I haven't got a funny answer. I can't tell you anything.
I thought as much. And Simon, you're doing Man Up next?
I am, yes. With Lake Bell, who I was doing Skype rehearsals with today. She's in Thailand doing a movie with Owen Wilson called The Coup, I think. And I'm very excited about that because she's brilliant. And it's a big talk thing as well. So with Naira's producing. And
well, the cool thing is that both movies are going to be released together as Ant-Man Up.
So that's what you can tell us. Like hot there scoop right off. And then you're doing presumably Mission Impossible 5, Star Wars, Star Trek. Everything.
Yeah, all of them.
All in the same week?
All the Star Wars questions are moot because I will be busy when Star Wars is shooting with Mission 5 and Star Trek 3 if all goes to plan. Mm-hmm. You know, that's... And I'm also possibly doing something in between Man Up and Mission, which I can't speak about right now.
Okay. We like starting the rumor that the third Star Trek is called Star Trek Into Jelly. If the Enterprise lands on a Blancmange planet, and it's called Star Trek Into Jelly. That's it.
That's a good note which to end. Edgar, Simon, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Empire Readers.
Thank you.